Next Chapter Podcasts. Hear Shakespeare like you've never heard before.
But thanks to all at once.
Who by next moon?
Thee we invite to see.
Who will be crowned at Scone?
Play On Podcasts are epic audio adventures reimagining timeless tales with award-winning actors. Listen today at playonpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Boil and bake.
Eye of newt and toe of frog, pull of bat and tongue of dog.
The 500. J.A.M. been walking us down through that 2012 edition, so it ain't nothing too new. Hundreds more to go and in need of a friend. The king of fleas for Angelo, talking the 500 until the end. Talking the 500 until the end. With my man J.A.M. on the 500, talking the 500 until the end.
The Once Over Twice. It's by X from the 1981 album Wild Gift. It's number 333 out of 500 on the 500 with Josh Adam Myers. I'm going to be in Texas this weekend, January 20th through the 23rd at the Plano House of Comedy. I'm going to be in Austin in April for a comedy festival. I am going to be in LA for the Jam in February. We're doing the Jam at Comedy Cellar February 15th. You can stream it on mintcomedy.com. Let me take a look at all my dates. This is somebody got mad at me for promoting my dates on a free podcast. He goes, he talks about all the stuff he's doing before he even releases, starts talking about the album. House of Comedy in Arizona in February 24th through whatever, 3 or 4 days of that is the 27th. Yeah, man, I got a bunch of stuff. Go to my website, joshadammyers.com. And follow me at Josh Adam Myers on all social media. All right, X. X is a band that keeps popping up on the podcast, and I've been very interested to finally dig into a record. Morty used to tell me about them, and big shout out to DJ Morty Coyle. My guest today is Tom DeSavia. Tom is a good friend of mine, and he is a big, big part of the LA punk scene, music scene here in Los Angeles and New York. Tom's written two books with John Doe from X, Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of LA Punk, More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of LA Punk. You can get both those books on Amazon. He's just a dude. He's a dude that when we were looking for a guest, Joe Sib set me up with him. And just talking to the guy, I was like, homie for life. This guy knows punk. This guy knows X. And this guy knows how to get down, baby. Rate, review, and most importantly, subscribe to the 500. Follow me at Josh Adam Myers on all social media. Email the podcast at 500podcast@gmail.com. Follow the Facebook group run by Crazy Evan, who just had, like, I think neck surgery. We love you, Evan. And for all things 500, go to the website, the500podcast.com. All right. Get to the album, Josh. All right, guys, 333 out of 500, Wild Gift by X.
Nice to meet you, man. We've not met.
We haven't, but I feel like I know you because everybody in the music industry knows you, dude.
But it's funny, I was thinking about it. We met before the whole End Times thing. I mean, when we were put together, right?
So we got connected, for the audience out there, we got connected. Well, I should preface it by saying this show is one of the hardest shows in the world to book, because it's not like it's every band is something that somebody has heard of, especially me, where I'm like, okay, who the fuck is going to do Richard and Linda Thompson? So I have my booker, Emily, I have my booker, Melissa, I have me going through the comics, but then it's just like, you get to a place where you're like, I have no idea who to ask for this record. So you reach out to someone like Joe Sib.
Right, and Joe.
I'm almost positive Joe is the one that linked us up.
Right.
Yeah, because he was like, dude, you know, Joe's like human Prozac, and he's just like, oh, brother, oh, dude, it'll be rad. I'll introduce you to Tom. Oh, he's the man. It'll be great. And I did you come through for us? I wonder, because I remember we talked on the phone.
Yes, I remember, because you called me about Big Star.
Yes.
I was like, and I love Big Star, but I hate people that go on like these TV shows and pretend they know about album and go like, yeah, John Lennon was going through a very, you know, intense time during this album.
Yeah.
And I put you with Ronnie Barnett from the Muffs.
Yes, who I love now. I mean, what a great dude, just good energy. He's just a big dork and I love him. He's like a music nerd. He brought the record with him. And the cool thing too, Tom, is that he's like, you know, we have like diehard fans of this podcast, but that comment less than Ronnie does on our stuff. Like we'll put up something, he'll be the first person to comment on it.
Awesome. And he's another one of those guys we've only met in a big group breakfast once, and we became like best friends, and I've never seen him again. So it's all online. It's just me giving him little hearts.
He's good at that, though. He's king of little hearts and rock fingers.
Everything. He's good at everything. You know, did he talk about his plaster cast?
Mm-mm.
You know the plaster casters?
No, I don't.
The plaster casters were this group of women in the 60s who were... there's no editing on this, right?
No. Well, yeah, we'll edit. We'll edit. Whatever you want. So just get as racist as you want. I know you're... Okay, well, I know you're Proud Boys.
They may, well, yeah, this is the
like, yeah, dude, right? If you guys are watching the video, if you guys are watching the video right now, Tom looks like he just celebrated the January 6th anniversary. You are definitely, you will not replace us.
Every picture that I have from the 90s has me with a little landing strip, and that's it. Like, yes. Shaved and this. And I was listening to country rock, you know, but no one would believe it by looking at the pictures. It just looks full Woodstock 99. But Ronnie, really quickly, because he's talked about this on podcasts. So I'll tell you, in the 60s, there was a group of women who went around making plaster casts of rock stars' dongs.
Yeah. Oh, yes. He might have mentioned it. But go ahead.
They actually, later in life, they went to him. And so somewhere... Ronnie has among the collection of like Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix, Ronnie Burnett's dick, which are fantastic. Which is I like you needed another reason to like him.
I mean, but you know, I bet it's longer than all of theirs because he's tall and skinny and white.
Yeah, but what has no one ever asked you or me for or ever will? Like, can we preserve that in a drawer somewhere on a shelf? Like,
dude, I want to do that. I want to do that. Can we figure out who can do that for me? I want to do that. I want to keep the Myers penis because nobody ever got my dad's. But I always remember your dad would be like in the bathroom and I'm a little kid and I'd walk by. I'd be like, Jesus Christ, my dad's got a huge penis. I hope my penis turns out like that one day. And I think it did. I think it did for a guy that's 5'9". I think it did. I think I'm...
Giant thumb.
Dude, it's but just to have that, just to have like a plaster cast to be like, well, what's that over there? Yeah, that's my sheenus. You know what I mean? That's my long. That's the thing. They yeah, just, you know, just go. You can have one. Take one with you as you leave. All right, because I can just talk. I can tell, like, even though this is really one of the first times me and you have looked at each other face to face, I've heard your name, and I remember we had John Doe on the podcast to talk about Bob Dylan. And I mentioned you and he lit up. And so you're kind of a guy that I feel is just around everything in music in some way, because everybody knows who you are. I've mentioned your name before and people are like, oh, dude, everybody knows Tom. So before we even get into X, just kind of explain to the audience, like, your relationship to the music industry and why you're that dude that's kind of around.
Wow. Well, first off, I was like, you know, figuring out all week if this was some sort of like producer's thing for you and you're trying to like get less ratings.
Dude, like, I just wanted, we don't want anybody to listen to this.
Yeah, it's like, who do we get? We'll get this Italian guy from the Valley. No one knows. No, I've been in the music business since I was 19.
Okay.
I got into it sort of accidentally. I'll be really brief. I had no other desires or skills and didn't know what the music business was. Grew up a pretty poor kid in the Valley. Didn't go to college. Got an internship that turned into a job that somehow has turned into a career. And, you know, I'm in constant, you know, waiting for the knock on the door where the entire industry is there going, we know you don't know anything at all. Yeah. I'm not that particularly good at anything, but I really like records. But just literally having grown, it's weird. Like I started working in the business at 19. And so I sort of spent a lot more time doing it. So just the people I knew, the friends, everybody was, you know, in music. And then, you know, the punchline, bring around full circle, I met Doe because X is one of my favorite bands of all time, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I met Doe in 96 when I was doing A&R at Elektra Records. And when I went there, I have these two weird conflicting obsessions. I'm equally obsessed with X and Linda Ronstadt. So yeah, that too. And so I went to it. And so Elektra was the home of what? X and Linda Ronstadt. So
when nice.
You know, it was that one brief minute in the music business where I got to say things like, well, I'll take the job if, you know, now it's like, I don't need your interest to hire me. But I said, I'll take the job if I could do an X box set and a Linda Ronstadt box set. And they were like, sure. And so I got to call all the members of X and compile this box set. And somewhere along the way, Doe and I became pals, much to the delight of my 13-year-old punk rock kid self. And starting then, I started bugging him to write a book because he'd tell me these stories and they were just great. And this, it wasn't, you know, it was the late 70s, early 80s. This period wasn't really documented great. Yeah. So he'd tell me stories I'd never heard. And it was just like, you know, I was, you know, there's all those really cool punk rock fans, rockabilly kids or just burly ones. And I was like in that like book club Shatner fan.
Yeah, you're a music nerd.
Yeah, you know that episode with the Tribbles, you know, and so yeah. I was asking about stuff and he was going like, I never want to write a book. And then years later his partner, his girlfriend Christy, started to bug him too. And finally he just said to me, he's like, all right, I'll do it if you do it with me and we make it just about LA punk and you have to get us a book deal. And I went, okay. And it hit a few people up, got calls back right away going like, that sounds like an awful idea. Don't ever call us again. And then really just was hung up by like every agent. I was like, we want to do a book about a scene that didn't really make any money.
Yeah.
And then another band I've worked with for years, this band called the Old 97s.
I've heard of them.
Great. Those are my other favorite guys. And the drummer, the guitar player, Kenner Phillip said, oh, I went to high school with the girl that does something with books. And I was like, can I talk to her? And be this amazing nonfiction agent in New York and a punk rock fan. And she got us a deal like within a week. So I wrote two books with John Doe and a variety of other great voices from the LA punk scene that came out and did pretty well. And both those did pretty good. And it was like a total dream come true. And so that's the, And then I had a bunch of jobs in between.
Just before we even get, because I have a follow up question to that. But you worked in A&R at Elektra, you said. Mm-hmm. What were the bands that you probably had your hand in launching?
The Old 97.
Okay, you're like I was like, I couldn't launch Linda Ronstadt, and X was already broken up.
I got there, and I was the guy who was like, I want to work with all these artists I love, and so I kept my job because I sold tens of records of the stuff that I signed. I mean, I was like,
tens.
Yeah, I was a liability for that company for 6 years, but I would stop in every once in a while and I'd be like, hey, I like Amy Lou Harris. Yeah. I like Buffalo Springfield. I'll do something on the Doors, you know? And so I was working with all this heritage stuff, and I got to work with Ronstadt on a bunch of records. And when I say A&R and work with Ronstadt, they found out I was a fan. They were like, we need a fan inside. And they would like, let me sign invoices and come visit them at the studio and stuff. But I wasn't at all going, you ladies should cut this. You know, I was just going like,
yeah.
But yeah, so but the old 90s, I signed a bunch of bands. I hated doing A&R. I hated it for a record label. Hated it.
Why?
Because I don't really have, and I'm not saying this for like cool points. I'm saying this, it's sort of sad. I don't have really commercial tastes. And it was like every 7 years, music will come around to what I like. And if I could, if something will kind of get in there, and then I'll like spend the next 7 years with that. I hope my bosses aren't listening. You know, with that one sort of went around. And otherwise, it's sort of like G chord rock guy, punk rock guy, roots rock guy. And so I would sign stuff that, and it was in the 90s when there was so much excess. So there was a lot of records I signed, like didn't even come out, didn't even get made. But it'd be a year of your time, you know, going. So the 97, somehow we eked out 3 band records and a solo record from them. And it was just in that period where they were allowed to be a young band and go on the road and get tour support. So they still have a career because they sort of got in there right before major labels weren't going, your Twitter followers are how many? No record deal for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I just always felt like out of place, and I'm generally sort of nervous anyway, so it was just 6 years of nerves.
Yeah, it seems like a high stressful job because you're always being relied on what you know, even if the band puts out a good record, like I mean like quality, not talking about sales, just a quality record, as they're just looking at you like, well, what are the numbers?
I just remember at one point in like 96, my boss at the time came to me and she was like, I'm bringing all this like country rock and stuff in. I'm like, oh, this person's really good. And she's like, what I'm looking for you is I'm looking for the next Limp Bizkit. And I'm just panicking because I'm like, I wouldn't assign Limp Bizkit. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how I'd find the next one. And so I just would sit there. And then every once in a while, like, I'd just like, could be like, oh, look, I'm making a Doors box set over here. You can ignore me. and there'd be other people like doing battle for the latest hot band. And I wish but when I say like, I don't want to say high stress because it's, high stress is pushing a bunch of wheelbarrows up a hill, you know, full of bricks.
I know what you mean.
But it was high stress in the, I would just sit there and be like, I don't have a backup plan. I didn't go to college. I don't have certable skills or talents. And I mean, I don't say that in an aw shucks way. I mean, like, I actually don't. I can't cook. I guess I could string a banjo if I needed to, but that's about it.
Are the Avett Brothers hiring? Because I can tune it. I can tune a banjo. Bro.
I didn't say I can tune it. This is where
you're fired.
Put words in my mouth, buddy.
But Tom, welcome to the life of a stand-up comic, dude. I mean, I want to quit constantly. I mean, I went up at literally last night at the Comedy Cellar at 2:30 in the morning, and the crowd was like drunk and wild, and I had a fine set, but I get off stage and I'm just like, why am I doing this to myself?
I don't know if I'm supposed to be saying this. I don't know if this is like an aristocrats thing that you're not supposed to talk about, but I've always been friends with comedians, and I think it's our mutual sense of dread.
Let's
smoke a lot of pot and get real sad and talk about how dreadful the next year is going to be, you know?
Maybe that's why we're friends. We barely know each other. I'm just like, he gets me and I get him. I can imagine, dude. But the old 97s, everything I've heard by them, I dig. And I mean, look at what you've done. So obviously it doesn't just have to do with, you know, your ear, but it's just, I think what keeps people in this business, music, and I'm talking behind the scenes too, is just you're fun to work with. People like you. You have a good energy. And if you do that, you know your shit. So that's all that really matters, right?
Well, that's real nice of you to say. Hopefully. Yeah. Sure.
You're doing pretty good so far, dude. They haven't called you out as an imposter yet.
What's the expression? Like old buildings and old whores get respect eventually.
I never heard that, but I'm fucking using that.
And it's like, all right. You know, you become like that, you know.
Dude, she'll give you the 5-minute special, dude. She's 76 years old. Trust me. You'll come like she's rolling up an old tube of toothpaste.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the one hit thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.
All right, let's get to the band. Let's get to the band, yes. Because I can talk to you, and we'll go, and we're going to go off in a bunch of directions. All right, sure. So I have to be completely honest. I heard X only through doing this podcast, and I don't even mean hearing their music. Just I heard the band brought up throughout the history of doing this in the last 2 or 3 years. How long have I been doing this? 3 years?
Just about, a little under.
Just about three. Oh yeah. So, wow. Jesus Christ. So in that time I keep hearing this band, I'm not going to lie. At first I thought it was the band King's X. Do you remember King's X?
Texas Rockers. Yes.
Yeah, and that's who I thought it was. Speaking of which, they had a good song. I'm gonna fucking remind me to look up King's X when this is over. So I started seeing the name come around. Yet I hadn't listened to it, and then I remember Mark Maron put out a tweet within the last year that was him saying, "I don't think there's a better punk rock band than X. I think X," and I think he mentioned a record. It might have been this one. It might have been Los Angeles. And for you to say them and Linda Ronstadt are like your fucking shit. So how does that happen? Because I don't think you're much older than I am.
Baby,
I'm 42. How old are you?
I'm 55.
Okay, goddamn, dude. If you're using Just for Men, dude, you look great.
It's getting in there. No, it's no kids in marijuana, but yeah.
It stops COVID too.
It does stop COVID. Yeah. And the only people that have read that are people like me and you, by the way.
Yeah. And other stoners and a bunch of comics.
Our Google alerts, like, are my life choices okay?
It's like, right. Wait, so I can take this bong hit and this will protect me from the poison that is outside?
But, you know, it was funny. So I grew up in the Valley.
Yeah.
I have my siblings are 12 and 14 years older than me. So I grew up fully on pop radio. I loved pop radio and on my brother's music. And my brother's music was Zeppelin, Sabbath, you know, all those sort of things, Doors, anything except Creedence. And he loved Linda Ronstadt. And specifically this one record, which is on the Rolling Stone list finally when they changed. It's the one improvement they made in the change to 2020. But so I just fell in love with that. And she was literally those records were road maps to me because she was an interpreter saying other people's songs. So that's how I found Elvis Costello and Neil Young and, you know, Lil George and just a million writers, Graham Parsons, went into all that whole thing.
Yeah.
And just LA country rock. And I just love sort of roots music. And that all started from those records of her, which were the first sort of alt country records, especially by a chick in like the late 60s, early 70s. And then she became this huge pop star. But those early records are really just really amazing roots records. And it's funny, like in our second punk rock book, having nothing to do with me, if you look in the index, she's referenced constantly by people, by like Annette from Blood on the Saddle or Maria from Lone Justice or the Bangles, as sort of that was their person. So I had all my music and I had pop music. And in like, right as I was getting to be like 13, pop music got really, really, really bad. And there was like flute solos instead of guitar solos in them. And
don't shit on Jethro Tull, dude. Do not shit on Jethro Tull. If that's where you're going.
I'll shit on Jethro Tull, but not now because you asked me to. But I'm talking more like a soft pop song where like literally where there's supposed to be a guitar solo. You're just like. And, you know, the ironic thing about being 13 is, you know, you're at your sexual prime with no getting laid.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. So you're just like, so all of a sudden, you know, your friend starts bringing these punk rock records and you're like, break things. This is awesome.
Yeah.
And X was like the LA band. I'm a native and you just knew they were everywhere. They were, you know, it was, I'm not into sports either. But that was like my team, you know, it was like, and you started to hear them. Your friends started to get the records. Rodney on K-Rock would play them. And they just had something completely, they absolutely changed my brain. They rewired my brain.
Why is that? What is it? Like, I mean, I listened to it. It's great. I'm not shitting on it whatsoever. Oh. It's great. But like I get the idea of like Lynn Ronstadt listening to all this and then suddenly you have the punk and the teenage angst and then you hear this, but like what is it that makes this band? They have three albums, Adam, on the top 500 list. They have two still for a band that I had never really heard of.
Total records or seven total records, whatever it is. The big thing was, I mean, when I heard it, I hated it because Exene's vocals were so jarring. And that's, I mean, I hadn't seen A Bad Side of the World. I'd only seen flute pop.
Yeah.
You know, so this was, and you know, when you're 13, 14, you know, grown up in the mean streets of Thousand Oaks, you know, you're, it was like me, an Italian, and my best Jewish friend were the ethnic kids at our high school. You know, it wasn't like you didn't see a lot of the hard world outside, but you started to like, you know, go through that 13-year-old angst thing. And then all of a sudden, this music came in that just bluntly on one thing, it was mine. It wasn't my brother's. He didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And my parents, who had been conditioned to like all sorts of rock and roll for my siblings, found something they hated. So it was like bonus, you know? So there's that thing as a kid, like, but with X, they were songs. And that's what got me. They're structured, they're pop songs. They're, you know, verse, chorus, verse, you know, bridge, they're, you know, it's funny, The Wild Gift is the most punk rock album out of all of them, which we could get into, but and I'd never heard, with the exception of maybe like an Everly Brothers song that was on my parents' radio station when I was a kid, I'd never heard harmony vocal as lead. Mm-hmm. And so everything about it was jarring. And then it was finally going to a show when I was 15 years old, which was a disaster and a thousand other ways, that scared the shit out of me. And I did one of those things where I walked into this world where I didn't belong with my Argyle sweater and my, you know, like my, you know, stoned on Valley weed with my friends. And all of a sudden there, it was like walking into hell.
Yeah.
And I was like, what was going on? And all four of them were so individualized. I've never seen anything like Exene. Anything like any of them. I never heard a drummer like DJ Bonebreak, never saw someone play like Billy Zoom. I'm 15. And then John, just like one of the great singers, I think, of rock and roll. And, you know, it's like this. And all this stuff is happening that makes no sense on stage. And I was standing at the back of this club. It was a club called the Country Club in Reseda, California. And I had my back up against the wall. I was stoned. I was 15. So you know what's going on there. My back was pressed up so hard against the wall that if I could have gone through it, I would have. And I was doing that thing like you do when you first get drunk and you go, if you get me through this, I will never go to a punk show again.
Yes. I've said that many times to God.
Yeah. And it was like, and it wasn't like in my head, people walk, I was wearing an Argyle sweater. I remember it because I'd worn it to the Stray Cat show previously and it went over pretty well. And I'm like, great. And, then I emerged from it and I was just like, oh, it's sort of like the first time you go down a hill really fast on your bike and you're scared and then you can't wait to go do it again.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it was like that. It was like that with me. And X just, you know, once I understood the the math of X. Once I understood, like, okay, these are not, this is not a combination of sounds that I've ever heard before. So it was so jarring when I was a little kid. So I was like, well, this isn't how pop music is supposed to sound. This isn't how songs are supposed to sound. Then it was just like, sort of like, and it sort of opened this door to just a, you know, for the 13-year-old emo me or 15-year-old emo me, really, it opened the world to this darker world.
Yeah.
There's something darker out there. But then musically, it just opened me up beyond. And I still love all the pop music stuff, and I still love all my roots music stuff. I like some of the punk rock stuff less that I get older, but not X. And it's just because there is a lot of it that was just sort of break things.
Yeah.
And just doesn't resonate anymore. I'm like, oh, I was kind of dumb. But I guess what I like is I was to drink cheap beer and, you know, just break things.
Of course. So tell me, what is that punk scene in LA like? Pre X, and then X comes. Like, what was the reaction to the music?
That first wave, it was before my time.
Okay, yeah.
Sure. But I came in, like, by the time I came in, it was after this record. They had a major label deal. They were on Elektra at this point. And they were what I knew about them, like I said, just because even these early indie records were getting on the, like, LA Times best of year end list. So you were aware of X. If you were at all into music, you were aware of it. If you listen to K-Rock, you were aware of them. But when they came into the scene, it was a lot of bands. It was the Screamers, it was X, it was the Go-Go's. There's a lot of bands that came in. And the thing that I love about LA punk the most, and I love punk rock in general, but LA punk was really the umbrella of what was punk rock was really wide reaching, from like X, who had, you know, real moments of, you know, rockabilly and nods to Woody Guthrie in it, and, you know, with a jazz drummer. And then you had like Los Lobos, who came out of the East LA, or The Brat, who are these great, you know, Latin or Mexican rock bands. And, you know, the Blasters, who are full on, you know, original rock and roll band, or the Screamers, who were really keyboard driven. And so it was just like punk rock was just basically everything that wasn't, you know,
regular rock and roll.
Yeah. And X is just like, you know, if there's a great documentary on them called The Unheard Music, and you couldn't go and see them and not have a reaction, you know? And that's what I think was, I mean, meaning like that reaction might've been like, oh, this is awful. This is the worst thing I ever heard. But it was so, you know, authentic and just different than anything else, that right away they just became critic darlings. And they put out their first single, which actually came out in 78, features two songs that were then on this, which was their second album.
Oh.
And so it was Adult Books and More Desperate. And so they're the kind of band, I mean, you know, like probably annoyingly so, you won't find a single rock critic in the world that will dislike X.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's like, but it's also, so right away, again, I wasn't there. I mean, but as soon as they sort of came on the scene and got signed to Slash in 80, I guess, they just became, you know, one of the biggest bands in the punk scene, and really developed, were, part, you know, John would argue this probably in his generosity, and he's right to a degree, but they would be one of the real architects of the scene.
So they come in, mm-hmm. and then they, in a sense, take over the LA punk rock scene. So they're
along with a bunch of other bands that were happening at the time. Yeah. But they were part of that wave of first bands and became one of the most notable. Certainly.
I mean, and would you say Black it has Flag. To deal? Yes, of course. Well, Black Flag is more of like a hardcore, like they're like Black Flag. Yes, they're in a sense on the same genre, but like those are totally different sounds.
But you'd see them and the Blasters and X on the same bill at a show.
Really?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because they didn't have anywhere else to play. So you'd see, you know, Social Distortion opening for X, or you know, Los Lobos, you know, were big in that punk scene. That's how they came up, because no one was going to. So that's what I mean. It became like this scene for outcasts, kind of.
Yeah.
And that's, so you'd go to a show and that's what I mean. You'd see there'd be all these different fan bases. I liked going to hardcore shows the least, solely because I felt like a victim every time I went there. I was a scrawny, scrawny, non-intimidating looking kid. You're just like sitting there terrified, but I'd go to those like Santa Monica Civic shows, but you know, you just have these different crowds show up, but it was all these punk bands sort of played together, you know, Black Flag and the Go-Go's on a bill and X on a bill was commonplace.
So they come out, the first album is Los Angeles, right?
Yep.
The first album is Los Angeles. That came out, Adam, when did that come out? In, go ahead.
I'm looking for it now, hold on.
I think came out in.
And this came out in 1980. I think I have it right here. This one came out in 1981.
80 and 80. Record.
Oh, wow.
Let me pull up my stuff, hold on.
Because it's the first X record I bought.
That's the first one. All right. So tell me about that. So tell me about, like, so you suddenly become this X fan. You get this record. Obviously, have you already heard Los Angeles?
Yeah. Well, and the reason I got this record was because Los Angeles was arguably the bigger record. And I had a couple of friends that had it. And the only way you heard records were if your buddies had them. And, you know, it was, you know, I'd save up to buy records and, at one point, you know, I saved up enough to go buy a record, and my buddies, we had enough copies in the group of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So I wild gift. So we'd have that. And so it's in a lot of ways, and almost every way, it's my first punk rock record. It's, you know, it means everything to me. It was just like, it was the one that I got to listen to on my own with my headphones and not just with my friends. And it was, so it was a really big deal, but I went there. The reason I got it was because I probably would have gotten Los Angeles if it was left to my own, because that was the song you were hearing on Rodney all the time. And just, you know, even, you know, out of the box, iconic album cover sort of thing. And I bought Wild Gift and just was like, you know, it got me.
You were hooked.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
So Adam found this, that since this is the second release by X, the guitarist Billy Zoom has described the record as almost thin sounding and laments that the album contained some of their best material, but suffered from production woes. But it came out and it was voted second best album of the year in the Village Voice, Village Voice's Paz and Jop poll. Only the Clash's Sandinista came ahead of it. So compared to the first record, as a fan, was this well received by you and all of your buddies?
Well, and it's like, look, it's on your list. I mean, it's funny. It is the record, weirdly enough, that I don't think gets enough credit. Like, no one's reissued, or well, I take it back. Fat Possum has put out all the band's records now, but like leading up to where you're getting like special editions of records or a magazine does a spotlight on a record, they always tend to go to Los Angeles or Under the Big Black Sun, which are these great albums. But this one is the most punk rock record, I think, in that there's a lot of like minute 30 second songs. Everything's really fast. I think most of the songs were written actually before Los Angeles on this record, and they went back into to do them. So it was exactly what I wanted. It was like, so, you know, it was quintessential punk rock to me. It falls into, like, if you played it for some, like, you can play some X songs for people and they'd be like, is this punk rock? Because there's a sax on it, or they're really beautiful melody lines. And this one is straight, like, and it's just so, I loved it. And I still think it's fantastic.
So as a guy who, like I said, is just getting into this band, the only song off of Los Angeles that I've actually listened to is the title track. So this is my first, like, you know, full X record. The first song was exactly what I was expecting.
Right.
And then it just starts going into different places. There's Roy Orbison sounding songs. There's, you know, White Girl, which, I mean, it's punk, but it's just, it's got the melodies. I can hear the influences that this band is probably, like, I don't think there's a Green Day without this band. I can hear Red Hot Chili Peppers in them a lot. Like who, before we get into who they influenced, who do you think influenced them when they, or have you talked? Because you're friends with them.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny, we don't get into those kind of discussions a lot, but I can tell you what I think that I think is a good bet.
Please.
Is, like, you know, 50s rock and roll, you know, Johnny Cochran, and, you know, the early roots music, you know, Merle Haggard, all sorts of folk music, you know. It's weird. They were just soaking everything. I know for a fact, and this is something we lead into, they were, John and Maxine specifically, were massive Doors fans.
Yeah.
Massive Doors fans. And in fact, so the first four X records were produced by Ray Manzarek from the Doors.
Wow.
Sort of is that LA lineage that reaches throughout. And it's funny, like, I'm not, and this is, you know, like, we've never really talked about that. My brother is, Doe is, like, I'm not the biggest Doors fan. Coming up, I appreciate them, but they're not like one of my bands. But I can't imagine what it was like being a kid, and the same thing, hearing, you know, 60s pop come through the radio, and then all of a sudden the Doors do. It was punk rock. And so it was like one of the biggest influences on them lyrically, just, oh, this can be done. Sort of the same experience I had, but more of them, like, oh, there's like, oh, there's more stuff for me to listen to. And for them, I think it was like, oh, there's a way for us to create art in this world.
What do you think differentiated, you know, was it the live show? Was it the music, like the albums, the energy? Like, what differentiated them from all the other bands? Because, like, I can kind of, I know this is gonna sound weird, to having listened to, we did the Go-Go's debut, is that the one with we got the beat on it? Yeah, so I can almost hear some of the same influences that are in this. Not fully, not, it's not like every song, go ahead.
Oh no, I was gonna say they were all, and I just, one quick correction, I wrote before I said Johnny Cochran, who I believe was the OJ attorney.
Yes, it was.
Cochran. So, yeah.
So, I was like, Johnny Cochran played on this? God, what a full life he had. You can hear it in the, she's a white girl, and she got the glove, she gonna quit.
I like Johnny Cochran's early stuff personally, but yeah. But they were all grown up in that same art environment, I think, doing Discovering at the same time. So they were all, you know, this is fanboy imagining what it was like, but I think they're all watching the same movies, listening to the same records, just doing like you and your buddies were, me and my buddies were. Someone was walking in going like, oh my God, have you heard the MC5? Let's listen to this. Or, you know, they were really like, John, who I know the best, obviously, is, you know, shockingly and impressively encyclopedic in his musical knowledge. And it's really fun to talk to him about music because he has such a better memory than I or anybody else I know does. But he really is, you know, though they never really talked about that, he was a student of music. And then, and he was also, you know, extremely artistic guy and wanted to express himself. And, you know, probably with that voice, he could have become a pop star, but he wasn't made to make pop music.
And he's a good looking guy too. I mean, he's, you know, he's, you can see it even
when
he's
back.
Yeah, he's a full package for sure. Tall dude. Is he tall? was like six.
I'm 5'10". See, he's probably like six, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I could tell, dude. Yeah, you got the ladies. Were they like, I mean, because also it's like a pretty diverse band. I mean, you have, so here, you know better. So tell me, everybody's in the band. Do me, if you don't mind, because I know you know the band. So kind of like give us a little bit of the history on the band.
Okay. Billy Zoom is the guitar player, and he has a rockabilly background. Amazing player. And that was the other thing too. Punk bands weren't known for their amazing players.
Yeah, and that, it's all power chords.
Nor was that the draw. You wanted break things a lot. And then these bands would come out every once in a while. So Billy was a really accomplished player. Doe is a classic songwriter and singer. He's just in the punk world, but he is just he was the bass player in the band. But just a great songwriter, like I said, like really knows classic song structure and sort of brought that into X. DJ, the drummer, I believe has like a jazz background, played like no one I've ever heard. It was just like a Captain Beefheart fanatic.
Yeah.
Brought that into the band. And then Xene is a poet. And like, I don't think ever set out to be in a band. She set out to be a poetry and they sort of came together and this thing happened. This sound happened. My favorite little factoid though of them is, so the band, as punk bands have, they have, you know, punk names. So John Doe is not his birth name. Billy Zoom is not his birth name. Xene Cervenka is not her birth name. DJ Bonebreak.
Come on, that's gotta be real.
Is real.
Oh, yeah. DJ Bonebreak. Oh my god, he's my favorite professional wrestler in AEW.
I mean, how would you not punk drummer? It was like it was destined for him. But yeah, I love
it. Out of all of them, DJ Bonebreak is the real one.
It is Donald John Bonebreak is on his birth certificate. So
I didn't even read DJ Bonebreak. I fucking love that dude. So this record comes out, you know, you hear it. What do you like about this record compared to Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, there wasn't, you know, again, at that age, you're not sitting there picking apart the intricacies of a record, what you like, this is awesome too, you know, so it was definitely that. But again, I loved it. I never, coming out of, say, the pop world, the listening to Linda Ronstadt songs and listening to Neil Young songs and listening to those kind of lyrics, you know, which, you know, were, you know, might've been about weed and bad relationships, but were really sort of, you know, comfortable to soak in. Like it was an easy for me to digest, where X's lyrics were the thing that always scared me, intrigued me, made me go like, you're not supposed to do that. Like the first song, the Once Over Twice, I remember hearing that the first time because the line is, I just heard the sad song by another band, sung by another man. He gave me the once over twice. And I just remember,
I love that.
What? Like, what? And the, you know, they had in the album had lyrics all handwritten by Xene, who's reading it. There's a little like, I could throw my lipsticks and bracelets like gravel, move to Alabama. I had some more scotch instead. And I was like, this makes no sense. Like, what is this? And that's why when I say it rewired my brain, it was like, oh, it doesn't have to be, I saw her standing there, you know? Yeah. And, you know, and in a way I always say like, cause when we were doing the book tours, I'd get asked a lot what the first punk rock song I ever heard was. And it was Helter Skelter by the Beatles, which
is punk. That is punk. Yeah.
Didn't sound like the band was supposed to sound. The lyrics made no sense. It was jarring. It was scary. I grew up in the Valley, so it was forbidden because we were too close to Spahn Ranch. Wasn't allowed to listen to it. My parents thought it would invoke some like killer hippies. True story. But it was like that. So it had that same sort of effect where at first when I heard Helter Skelter, I'm like, oh, I don't like this. You know, this isn't.
Yeah.
This, and you're just going,
it's not an easy listen to you right off the jump. It's like more or less, I think when you start to appreciate the Beatles and you fall in love with them and then you hear it and then you're like, and over time you're like, oh, this is one of their best songs.
Yeah, and I just probably felt you when I was like 8 or 9 from my brother, and it was just like, you know, that's not like those other songs.
Yeah.
But like that thing we were talking about, that like, I'll be good if I never hear this again, but then it's sort of in you and it just sort of keeps going, like, and then it's forbidden by the parents, which again adds that level of,
oh yeah,
I gotta listen to this as much as I possibly can.
Oh yeah, dude. You keep mentioning, you know, that you know John Doe, and I know you've written 2 books with him, right?
Yeah.
So how do you, so going from a fan, how do you become friends with John Doe?
It was, we were making that record, the Xbox set together. And it was funny because I've been, and it's, this is a weird way to say it, but look, I'm sure you, it's the same for you in your world. I don't, you know, because I've done this my whole life since I was like 19, I don't really get like nervous around musicians. I don't really get, I mean, there's some that I just don't want to meet. There's certain ones that I just like, I never want to meet. I got to meet Niccolo once and I couldn't say anything. So I knew I'd blurt out a thank you for the music, you know, yeah. Sort of. Don't want to do that. But so with Doe, we just hit it off and I was such a fan and he was just such an, you know, a good regular guy. And we honestly, as cliche it says, we just kind of became pals. And he was living outside of LA. So when he would drive into town to do shows a lot, he'd stay, crash with me, and or we'd go grab dinner or I'd just go see him whenever he played. And so we just always kept in touch and became friends. We'd see a movie once in a while, that sort of thing. I mean, for sure, the 13-year and old in me is always a little present. Every once in a while, it's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, this was a guy that completely was responsible for putting me on the path I'm on, you know? And I, every once in a while, like, I'll sort of have that feeling, which is like, you know, I become the Star Trek kid. I'm like, oh shit. You know, like, this is cool. But it's just been now 25 years or something like that. And just because we did the books together, we were together so much during that. And I don't think I wouldn't have been able to do it if I was in like fan mode the whole time, but it was weird. We did the book has a ton of people in it, from Henry Rollins to Tony Hawk to Shepard Fairey. All these people had experiences with the Go-Go's. And so when we did it, we also recorded an audio book and everyone read their own chapters in it. So everyone that wrote something read their own, Billy Joe Armstrong and blah, 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 and all these people throughout. And so as I was communicating with people, it was kind of wild because I was getting this sort of knighted by John, like, it's cool to talk to this guy and then people are comfortable talking to you. And at that point we were doing that, the 15-year-old me was totally present when it was like,
yeah,
hello, Mr. Chris D from the Flesh Eaters. You know, and then meeting them, I would definitely there's times I would just stay in the back of the room and just be like, you know, just in the same way I didn't belong in that first punk show, I didn't belong among these people, but they're all really super nice. But yeah, there's every once in a while, like, you know, John will be here and he'll pull out a bass that I've seen him play forever. And I'll just be like, oh, right.
Yeah. You fanboy out. So then what's the process behind you and John basically becoming collaborators? Like, whose idea was it? Like,
I bugged him to write a book. I was bugging him for years because he was telling these great stories and his stories were better than the stories that were out there that weren't real. And they were, and he's a good storyteller. He's really funny and he's really detailed and he's just a good storyteller as he is a songwriter. So I was bugging him and he was just like, fuck you. No, I'm not writing a book. I'm not writing a book. I'm not writing a book. And he was really hardcore. He was like, I'm not going to write an X book. That's bullshit. I'm not going to write about, and he's like, and I'm not going to write about the punk scene from my view, because the reality was like, probably, you know, a little after Wild Gift came out, they went on the road. They were one of the first bands also from LA to actually have a deal and be able to go out and tour. Mm-hmm. So they weren't around for a lot of stuff that was happening in their wake in the early 80s. They'd come back and play here a ton, but they weren't around. So he came up with this idea, if we gave people topics and had everyone write from their own perspective, and what we got the deal, I should say too, it can be told now, we got the deal. We sort of didn't expect to get the deal. And then we had a book to write. And we were like, we don't know what to write about. Like, we really were like, and John came up with the idea. It's like, all right, let's give, we know how to make albums. So let's give people these topics, get them to write chapter, and then we'll sequence it together like a record. And so that's what we did. So we went to like Jane Wiedlin and said, hey, write about that apartment building you were in that all the punks were hanging out in. Hey, Rollins, talk about the hardcore scene coming up. You know, just on and on, you know, of you know, different aspects of the scene. And we got them in. And the first couple we got were Jane Wiedlin's and a woman named Pleasant Gaiman, who is like a scenester, in bands, wrote for the LA Weekly, and is just like the biggest personality of life. And those two chapters came in, and they're two of the best things we wrote about. And they were really close. And we didn't let anybody else know what anyone else was writing about or read anybody else's things. And so they wrote these two things that were almost like two views of different cameras on the same scene. And it just read great. And we went like, oh shit, I think we have a book. So we got all these chapters in from people. And then John and I wrote the little interstitial bits that went between them to sort of tie it together into a narrative. But we did both books in the confines of 1 year. And we probably wrote all our stuff in the confines of 2 months.
You got everybody else to work for you. That was a smart thing. It's like, we got a book deal. Hey, go ahead and write three chapters for me. Write two. And John, don't write anything. Not yet. Hold out and write. Give me two sentences in 15 minutes.
John's lying, but he didn't want to paint the fence by himself. So you got everyone else to paint the fence. And that's sort of what happened. And then it just went together. And we decided to base the first book on the first fight, because we sort of looked at the LA scene, the original scene happening from 77 to 87.
Yeah.
And then basically it was like metal won, then Guns N' Roses won, and punk rock lost. And so we took the first book just to give it some sort of cohesiveness. John was like, let's just do the first 5 years. And I was all for it because I wasn't around that time. And that's what I wanted to know about as a fan. So I'm like, this is great. And then the book came out and did well. We actually got a Grammy nomination and we lost it to Carol Burnett.
Ah, that bitch.
That bitch. Oh. She's been trolling me. So how do you get mad losing to Carol Burnett? We did. Spoiler alert. How do you? And so then when they wanted a second book, we were like, okay, we'll do the next 5 years. So then the second book's the next 5 years. And then we're not doing another one ever again because we got along too well.
You don't want to fuck it up.
It's sort of like, having that third kid. We're like, he's going to be a, you know, we're
we'll sue him.
So we have to.
You mentioned, you were talking about like documenting that scene, you know, Penelope Spheres made The Decline of Western Civilization about the LA punk scene, which I've watched. And that's where I'd seen X like mentioned. Right. And I only watched it recently. But so, you know, being from, you know, from you seeing that and what you know about that and the books and everything, how important was it to document that time in the music scene? And do you know what it did to the popularity of these artists?
Yeah. I mean, it's wild. It did a couple things that I think were really important. And I loved all those movies, but it was funny. Like, I thought that's what punk rock was just people doing speed all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like I literally was like, that's what that, okay, this is awesome. It's just people doing speed and some kid named Eugene I have to avoid who's got a shaved head who's going to shit. But the, what the, like, a big thing that happened, I think, as partial, I like, we're partially responsible for stuff that's happened. I think there's a lot of great writers and great historians out there who are now documenting a lot of stuff, but the Go-Go's being reframed historically accurately is coming up in the punk scene, which people didn't know, and they made their own documentary, and a lot of people just thought they popped out onto the radio with these hit songs, and they were punk as fuck. If you go listen to those early demos,
if you wanted to party and you thought you could party, the Go-Go's would out party you.
I mean, I didn't know them during that time, but I know them now, and they're pretty, and the stories they tell in the book. But yeah, they were they were wild. And they were also one of those bands, they were learning to play as they got the band together, with the exception of Charlotte, who was the musician, and Gina, the drummer. But they came together just fabulously punk rock, you know, just like slamming it out. So it recaptured them. There's a band that, what I loved about it was, like I said, we didn't tell anybody what anybody else was writing about. And the band that everybody, that I found was everybody's favorite band, was this band called The Screamers, who had never put out a record, had a really famous logo, but had never put out a record.
Yeah.
And so they were this sort of infamous band, very keyboard led, no guitar sort of thing. Like, they reissued officially like their demos for the first time after this. This band called The Brat, who was, I think, this amazing band from the East LA scene, who, when I say the music was gone, like, it was, they were indie records. They weren't on Spotify. You couldn't find them for less than $500 if you went to a store. So their records started to get reissued. And as we did book tours, I just found people were just discovering these bands by reading this and going like, oh, I really like Henry Rollins. And Henry Rollins is talking about, you know, Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs. I'm making this up. And so I looked them up and I really liked that band. So I just found, I think it helped get awareness up for a lot of people. And it helped, you know, I look at the LA punk scene sort of like an art scene, for lack of a better word, meaning like Basquiat or something like that. It's not like, it's just all these people were creating this time, and it was so regional that you only heard it if you lived local. There was no way to hear it. And so now, in the same way, like, there's a point we heard about Basquiat, which I didn't know who that was until it became
global,
bigger.
Yeah.
You know, or Keith Haring, or any of those artists that came out of, you know, I remember when I learned about the Warhol scene and how it tied into Belvedere, but I was older when I was like, oh, there's this scene. And so the world is sort of finding out now about these regional punk rock scenes, be it, you know, London's been greatly documented, New York's been greatly documented, LA is now being really well documented, but the Midwest, San Francisco, all these regional areas, you really, the only way you could hear the bands was if you lived there. And so now it's getting out wider, and people, and you can find music. Like I said, we used to have to buy records to hear them. Now someone can be listening to reading the chapter and be like, oh, I want to hear what this band sounds like.
Yeah.
Hey, you, do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends, Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony, also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided, why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
Because you had mentioned they're fans of The Doors, and Ray Manzarek produces this record. Do you know how they got that to happen?
You know, this is where, yeah, I mean, you got to get into this. It's in the book, and I'm trying to remember who put them together. But they were being compared to The Doors at the time. And I think it was as Hollywood as Manzarek came to a show and saw him and went, holy shit.
Like, and just got blown away?
Yeah, and they did, and I know they were such fans of his. He was fans of theirs, and they cut a version of Soul Kitchen that's, I knew before I knew The Doors version of Soul Kitchen. Sounds nothing like The Doors version of Soul Kitchen. But they were bonded. They did four albums together, and they'll even talk, they were supposed to do a fifth. And at that point, the record label, it was when I say when sort of metal won, the record label came in and went, no, we're getting you a hit producer. And they got this guy who did all these Dokken records and made this really big, heavy record for him. And that record was supposed to be made with Manzarek. And I know they bemoaned, like, because the songs are great, but it's such a, sounds like a Joan Jett record kind of in a lot of ways. Got Wild Thing, which you probably remember from the movie Major League.
Oh, well, I do.
Sessions, not on that album, but from the same sessions. But they just really had that thing with Ray where, you know, it's the cliched thing. I wasn't there. It's not my band. But if I were, you know, to guess, I would say it was one of those fifth members of the band thing. He completely got them. They completely got him, and they were. And it's funny what you mentioned at one point, Billy saying, "Oh, this record sounds thin and it was really cheap." They didn't have any money, so these records were made really cheap. As a result, they came out sounding pretty timeless. They're just rock and roll records.
Yes,
they couldn't afford to put anything that sounded really cool in 1981 on it if they even wanted to, but it just didn't happen, I think, because they didn't have the budget to.
No, you know, it's funny that you say that, because it's like, it doesn't, this holds up. This record holds up. It doesn't feel like, oh, this is 1981. This feels like this could have come out 2 months ago and it still pops.
That's what I mean about comparing it to all those other more iconic bands. It's just one of those records where, you know, I'll listen to one of my beloved old Ronstadt records. I'll be like, wow, that's loud cowbell. That cowbell is pretty high in the mix. You know, there's just,
yeah.
Like, all right, this was the 70s. And then you find that record that just, you go, wow, I couldn't tell you who the president was. I don't know what movie star was big then. Like, it doesn't bring some kind of pop culture association to you. It's just 30 minutes of punching you in the face, you know?
Yeah, I would put it on and I would just be like, it'd be over before it began. And I'd be like, oh my God. But it was like, you would go up and down. There's so many peaks and valleys and so many different styles of music in it. And, you know, the opener is just such a banger. And then to follow that up with We're Desperate, and then Adult Books, which I remember it started. I was like, I don't think I'm going to like this. And then I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, I love this song. And it just goes on and on. And I mean, it's White Girl. I mean, there's so many good tracks on this. So let's see if there's any interesting facts. Adam mentioned White Girls. Let me find it. White Girl. This is the only single released from the record. The romantic tension that twists in the heart of this, one of X's most beloved songs, is apparently rooted in real life. Although singer and bassist John Doe was married to fellow singer Exene at the time, he wrote White Girl about whom Lorna Doom, the bassist of the Germs.
Yes.
This fact lends a certain extra weight to Exene's rather tired sounding echoes of Doe's more fervid descriptors. She's blonde, 19, and to the fact that her vinegary harmony vocals on the chorus sound more like a sigh of resignation than anything else. Do you know any history about that you can fill us in with?
Funny, I do, and it's funny. The one thing is, I never do, just doing A&R and working with songwriters, I never ask songwriters what a song's about.
Yeah.
So you live through it with them, and you're like, you know the breakup that happened, and you know the song was written, so you kind of know, but yeah, we all kind of have our own mini movie playing in our head for the best song. So I just never really asked, but for this one, he did talk about it in the book, and he said he finally revealed, but yeah, it was written about a moment he had with Lorna Doom from the Germs, who's the bass player in one of the most ill-fated and now sort of legendary punk bands, you know, produced by Joan Jett, Darby Crash. Mm-hmm. Singer died the same day as John Lennon, so he got a little dwarfed. There's a line in there that's leaving a trail of blue and black, which was the Germs logo colors. And so, yes, it was like I said, John's own words are out there, but it was, they were the king and queen of punk rock. They were married and divorced and remained in the band together. And so, like, any Richard Linda Thompson to, I don't know, think of another couple that's in rock and roll, they don't often continue to make music together. And they obviously, you know, their relationship and their time together came out in the music, I'm sure. And so this, he did come out and fess up to being an alley cat.
All right, let's do some rap. Is there anything else, Adam, that we should mention about this record?
That was the big one right there, I think.
That was the biggie?
Good find, Adam.
Yeah, dude. This was your show, Tom. You were the host today.
Your back's got to be hurting by carrying us today. So,
oh yeah, you carried this shit, dude. You've 100% carried it. All right,
least listened to show ever.
All right, rapid fire. We ask all the guests this. Let me pull up my answers just so I have it. All right, favorite song on the record?
We're Desperate, because it said the word "fuck" in it. So I thought it was amazing. And you'd wait during the live shows for, like, I was 15. I was like, are they going to say it? Are they going to say it? Of course they were going to say it. But I love that song. Love that song.
I, it's funny. The opener at first was my favorite song because it was so catchy. Then it went to Adult Books because that rules too. And then I finally settled on White Girl.
Right on.
That's the one that I've just kept humming and I've just, you know, over and over. Least favorite song on the record. One that you might skip over.
Gosh. I mean, not to log roll and sound like a sycophant here. I don't think there is one. I guess I've just
I get it, it's tough.
It really is. I mean, if I had to skip one. Maybe when our love passed out on the couch, but I love it. So, but sorry, that was a boring answer.
Nah, it's a goodie. It's a goodie because it came from the heart and I understood how torn you were. Get that out. All right. What song on this record would you fuck to?
Well, 15-year-old me, all of them, because they're all frantic and fast. There's no, like, Roxy Music song in this record, though. I'm trying to think, like, what would... I guess Universe Corner or Adult Books have good grooves. I'd say Adult Books. That's got a good groove.
I picked Adult Books, too. Adult Books, too. So you know, the books, the documentaries, the albums, this list, everything, you know, what would you say is the legacy of X?
Oh, I mean, look, they're, I think they are one of the most important rock and roll bands of the 20th century, which is a bold thing to say, but, you know, there's the cliche, like, everybody that got an X record, it either made them form a band, it made them read a book, it made, and what blows me away, and the reason I say that, it's like they played a couple of shows this year. They did a big show at the Greek. And when I went to that show, it was mostly our age. It was the Greek. And it was like our age to sort of 70. Yeah. You know, people that were around. And it was like, you know, people went, had some nice wine and then went to the X show. And it was great. It was sold out at the Greek. It was LA, homecoming. And then just a few weeks ago, they did two nights at the Terragram. And it was all fucking kids. And it was all, and the kids looked exactly like we did then, meaning like there was the greasers, there was the girls that looked like Betty Page with their, you know, there's the poetry kids, there was the, you know, the jocks, there was the, and it was just like, it's sort of a universal thing. I mean, in a way, John would punch me in the eye if he heard me say this. Beatles, Zeppelin, Beach Boys, it's just, they're one of those rites of passage band where it means the same thing to everyone when they hear it the first time. As opposed to, I think when you're singing about being desperate and you're singing about just being frustrated and not fitting in, it's sort of the Bowie thing. They just never had hits. You know, there was never really hits, but at the same point, that thing you do factor hasn't followed them around. You know what I mean? Where it's like, yeah, they're the ones that did that one song. You know, like a lot of people from LA know Los Angeles. But, you know, people know albums by this band mostly. And that's really interesting. And so I just think that, you know, I just find like we were both shocked and happy with how well the book was received. But it was funny, the sort of letters and notes and just the people that would come to the signings, everyone had the exact same story I did, which was like, oh, my God, I heard this and I didn't know this world was there when it was, or if they were around my age or so, like everyone sort of had that same experience. And I find like, it's, you know, it's like, I think that it still does. Like if you're hearing a Clash record for the first time at 13, it's going to hit you the same way it probably hit a kid hearing it at 13 in 1980, 81.
Totally. Dude, Tom, this was great. I can't thank you enough, man. You know, like I said, dude, you're the kind of guy that it's just like, I get it. I get why you're around. I get why you have a great energy. And this was so much fun. And I mean this sincerely, dude, you were the perfect guest for this because you know so much.
Dude, that was so much fun. I love, and again, not to log roll too much, but I fucking love your podcast, man. I got turned on to it. It's really... you're doing the Lord's work out there. It's funny as hell, and it's great.
Thank you. Anything you want to promote, go ahead.
Two books out on Hachette for physical copies and Penguin Random House for the audiobooks. The audiobooks are fun. If you got Audible, it's every author reading their own chapter. And so it's a fun little history book. And there's some musical performances and some ad-libbing on the audiobooks that make it different from the books. So those are out there.
So people.
Under the Big Black Sun and More Fun in the New World. And, oh, I should plug, X put out a fucking great record during the pandemic called Alphabet Lambs that they weren't able to properly tour on. That's out on Fat Possum. And John Doe and his folk trio have a record coming out on Fat Possum sometime, I think, in the spring. So be on the lookout for those.
Check that out, everybody. Get the books. Get the books. Keep listening to this music. Tom, I can't thank you enough, man. Thank you so much, brother.
It's fun, man.
What I tell you, the one and only Tom DeSavia. Follow him on Instagram at DeSavia, A with the circle around it, DeSavia. And follow him on Twitter at T DeSavia. That's TDeSavia. For listener shout out this week, I want to give this dude sends me messages all the time, and I want to give him a big shout out. Michael Lane Heath. He is a writer, a poet, musician, and he's got, I think, his own podcast called My Week Beats Your Year, Counters with Lou Reed. Maybe that was a book. I don't know, but all I know is he is a diehard fan. At Michael Lane SF. Thank you, buddy, for listening. All right, we just listened to X from 81. Check out this week's band of the week, Adult Books. They're an LA-born post-punk band. You're listening to their song Sparrows on the Razor Wire from their album Grecian Urn. And you can hear those songs on the website, the500podcast.com. Send us your music, guys. Big shout-out to Black Magic, though. Those are my homies up in Vancouver. Big shout-out to Black Magic. But listen to these guys. They're pretty cool, too. Next week, Richard and Linda Thompson week. Shoot Out the Lights from 1982. Do your homework. Doogle doogle.
Flew into St. Louis at midnight. Empty tunnels and salt on the sidewalks. Snow falling down in the streetlights. Making snow angels in a rental car parking lot. We felt so alive. You still did.
Relatives, we'll play free. 500. Keeping it fleecy for the Fleece Nation. On the 500.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
Next Chapter Podcasts.